This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
KBOO Community Events page for more information or firstunitarian.org.
Water. This is unprecedented. I got to tell people, you are, first of all, listening to KBOO 90.7 your FM dial in Portland. I'm R. Graham. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. We have a guest. We'll introduce him in a moment, but I got to explain something. Between now and the middle of the electoral process, I have persuaded Abe to put a lot of energy into opposing the fluoride measure that was brought onto the ballot by concerned citizens from a variety of communities. My personal concern, and it is very personal, is that my partner is extremely chemically sensitive. If fluoridation passes, she will face the necessity of purchasing our water. And that's an expense, and it's a hassle, and it's unnecessary. Fluoridation is a good idea for children's teeth. There are ways to provide fluoridation very cheaply that don't involve the entire water supply. So I'm, and thank you, Abe, I'm going to put some energy onto this sucker.
Here's why I'm interested in this subject.
Okay.
I think, like a lot of people, I assume the conventional wisdom was true, that fluoridated water supply was a good thing to do, that it had a significant salutary effect on dental health on a large scale. It was one of the more democratic public health works that we could institute, because who doesn't ingest water? Everybody does, even the poorest among us. And I thought, really, without thinking about it too much, that it's a pretty good idea. But after digging into this subject a little more, I wouldn't say I'm a member of the rabid anti-fluoride ranks, but there's enough doubt in my mind to oppose this measure. And there's an additional reason, in that I'm going to have a kid this summer. And
congratulations.
Thank you. Well, not me personally, but I was involved.
I understand. Young, I got the physiology down pretty good.
Infants are among the most vulnerable populations in terms of the deleterious effects of fluoride ingestion.
Right.
So I feel like I got some skin in the game here.
Yeah. So what we're doing is we're putting some energy onto this, and Howard Peterson is...
Patterson.
Patterson, I'm
thank
sorry,
you.
Is here.
We Pattersons are very sensitive about the Peterson thing, but
oh,
but
yes. Well, I understand. It's the tomato-tomato phenomenon.
Something like that.
So... So, Howard, what are your credentials and why are you here?
Well, I am a Master of Environmental Management with a master's from PSU with a concentration on water quality, and I also have a professional certificate in water restoration. Before these things happened, I was a performer for many years. I was one of the Flying Karamazov brothers, where my primary mission was in conveying esoteric scientific concepts to a lay audience, and once in a while I juggled. So it... My background does fold into this pretty well. Now, when this fluoride issue came up last fall, like most Americans, I thought, well, you know, fluoride, it's a good thing, and only crazy right-wing people oppose it. So, but I did know that fluoride was a toxin, so I started to research the scientific literature. And the first surprise was that because of my my background is largely environmental, so my first question was, what is the effect on the environment? Because, you know, you're putting it into the water and putting the water into the river system. Humans only drink about 1% of the water that goes through the water system. Everything else goes straight into the environment. So
through irrigation and runoff and waste and what have you.
Exactly. And the old pass-through of the human system.
Well, that also happens. Indeed. And we don't strain out much of it. Well, let's get to some. At fairly low concentrations, it is lethal to the what testing has been done mostly on rainbow trout. It's the lab rat of fish science, and salmonids, the salmon and trout, are much more sensitive to fluoride than other fish. We've discovered that. We've discovered that it's lethal at about 3.5 parts per million. Now, the optimal concentration that fluoride proponents have been putting forward for many, many years has been 1 part per million, somewhere between 0.7 and 1.2 parts per million. So 1 is a good convenient figure. And 3.5 is enough to kill them. That's okay. So that's pretty potent. At a third of that, is it going to have no effect at all? It seems unlikely. So we know that. We know that it's hardness dependent and temperature dependent. So the warmer the water is, the more lethal a small concentration of fluoride becomes. And with global warming, our waters are likely to become somewhat warmer, so fluoride will become more of an issue in that direction. Our waters are fairly soft. And in fact, fluoride becomes more lethal as water hardness goes down. Fluoride becomes more lethal when the water is harder. There's more calcium in it, and that competes with the other minerals apparently, and keeps fluoride from being absorbed quite as quickly. So when an animal takes fluoride into its system, in the case of fish, it's through the gills. A fish in fresh water will take 2.5 times its body volume an hour in water through its body. So a lot of fluoride is passing through. The fluoride is toxic. The body observes it in the tissues and can excrete some of it. Generally, the rule is about half. So the other half, it puts it into the bones and teeth of a vertebrate or into the exoskeleton of an invertebrate. So it accumulates. The term is bioaccumulation. It doesn't go away. There continues to be more and more of this toxic substance that accumulates. Now the toxicity of fluoride has been well established for a very long time. In the 1850s, they were noticing next to metal smelting plants, people were losing crops, they were losing livestock, people's health was affected. Nobody knew what it was, but they were winning lawsuits anyway. And so the first solution was to build taller smokestacks. So whatever it is will go east and that'll be good. It's not our problem anymore. But by the early 20th century, they identified fluorine as the actual substance. So I want to talk about fluorine fluoride for just a second. Fluorine is an element. It's related to chlorine. It's one step up in the periodic table, same family, the halide family. Extremely reactive compound. It's very unstable in its pure form, and it wants to grab an electron. And in which case it's ionized, has a negative charge of 1, and then it's called fluoride. That's what fluoride is. It's just the stable form of fluorine.
This is a way of saying that you're not usually or very rarely going to find fluorine in its elemental form because it likes to bond with other stuff.
That's correct.
Right.
So it became clear that it was a toxin if you release it into the atmosphere, and so you're not allowed to release it into the atmosphere anymore. And if you have it in solid or liquid form, you are supposed to dispose of it in a landfill because it's this highly reactive compound. Its primary source was originally aluminum smelting, but right now it's mostly phosphate fertilizer production. As I understand it, the rocks that have the phosphate in them have fluorine in them too, and when you crunch them up, the fluorine is released. And then there are scrubbers, take it out of the smokestack, put it into usually a compound called fluorosilicic acid, which is fluorine with 6 silicon atoms attached to it.
And this is not how you usually find fluoride in nature. It's usually a salt.
That's That is correct.
Sodium fluoride, uh-huh. much like sodium chloride.
Right.
It's a hard mineral salt.
That's correct.
And it's prevalent all over the Earth's crust. You're going to find it pretty much everywhere you go. Some places more concentrated than others.
That's right. And the initial research was done in the early 30s when they found that there were high concentrations of fluoride in water in Montana, Wyoming kind of area. And the Public Health Service sent a scientist to a dental scientist to go check that out, and he found that there were high levels of fluorosis in the children living in these areas, but he sort of had an idea that maybe their rate of cavities was lower, and he said, well, if we can find the right concentration, maybe we can use fluoride to prevent cavities. This went back to public health. They did a couple of experiments and decided that was a wonderful idea. I am hesitant to go too deeply into the industrial motivations for why that happened at the time that it happened, because whether there's a conspiracy or not, when you start talking about it, you sound like a conspiracy theorist. But there is suffice it to say that there is a large industrial and corporate component to the regulatory aspects of the American government.
You're kidding.
No, I have observed this. And we'll come back to that.
Okay.
So, fluoride, we know that at low concentrations it's lethal to salmonids. Salmonids is trout and salmon.
Right.
We use the term interchangeably. So, there's only been one real-world study, really, on the relationship between low concentrations of fluoride and salmon. It happened in the 80s. The study's called Damkayer and Day. Two scientists who worked with the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. They had recently invented these magnetic tags that they could put into salmon and follow actually where individual salmon were going, because nobody had any idea before. And what they discovered was that it was taking them about one day to cross through a fish ladder at each of the dams on the Columbia. But when they got to John Day, it was taking them closer to a week. And they also found that between Bonneville and McNary, more than half the fish were dying. About 55% of the fish were dying. And that was seemed like an unacceptable level of loss. So John Day was obviously where the problem was happening. And they found that they were congregating at the entrances to the fish ladders, but they wouldn't go in. They tried changing the flow. They tried changing where the entrances were. Nothing seemed to work. So they started analyzing the water to see what kind of pollutants might be in the water. And they found levels of fluoride between 0.3 and 0.5 parts per million. And they quickly realized that there was an aluminum plant next to the dam. And now the aluminum plants on the Columbia, or the dams on the Columbia, are largely there to provide electricity for aluminum production to make war material for World War II. And it worked and we won, so that's great. But thanks to all that aluminum and Boeing. So, but they were still making aluminum right next to the Columbia and putting about 800 pounds of fluoride into the river every day. So in 83, the EPA came down on this aluminum plant and said, you can't just dump this stuff in the water. And so they put most of it in a landfill, cut down their fluoride dumping into the river by about three quarters. The level went down to between 0.1 and 0.2 parts per million, and the salmon started going through. They would take a day instead of a week for them to go through, and the unaccounted loss is the term of fish between Bonneville and McNary dropped to 5% and then down to 1%. So that's great because you know they can't all make it. But so then with this information, Damkayer and Day then conducted a controlled experiment at Big Beef Creek Research Center in Washington State. They had a system with two flumes, and wild salmon were introduced to this flume. Chinooks, chums, and cohos all were allowed to go through this thing, and they would put fluoride in one flume and not in the other flume, and they'd randomly assign it, so it was, like a real experiment. And they found that down to 0.3 parts per million, they would avoid the fluoride, and some of them wouldn't go in at all. They'd just say, sorry, I'm not interested in this whole game, and they wouldn't go into the flume. And it wasn't until they dialed it down to 0.2 parts per million that the salmon started not selecting between one or the other. They didn't seem to avoid the fluoride, although a significant portion of them still wouldn't play. They wouldn't go in. So Dam Kayer and Day proposed 0.2 parts per million as a top threshold for how much fluoride should be going into Northwest waters. Now remember, we're talking about 1 part per million is the fluoridation level, 0.2 parts per million is the acceptable level they suggested, and it's in fact still high. They're still at concentrations lower than 0.2, there's still some hesitation. Salmon are really, really sensitive to fluoride. They are able to detect it in tiny, tiny quantities, and they don't like it. And that's it. That's all the data there is. 1989 is when they published this. It was a huge study. You'd think there would be some follow-up. And if it were any other chemical, there probably would have been by now. And I've talked to a bunch of environmental scientists about this who choose to remain nameless. And they said, frankly, everybody is afraid of losing their funding. It's not an ill-founded fear. The list of scientists who have lost professional licenses, who have lost membership in professional organizations, and actually who have lost high-ranking jobs when they started to suggest that fluoride was possibly dangerous, is very long. There are dozens of people to whom this has happened, and nobody wants to stick their neck out, and that's understandable. But so now one of the things that fluoride proponents have said is, well, the level of fluoride, the natural background level of fluoride in the sea is 1.4 parts per million approximately. And so salmon are doing fine with that, so why should 1 part per million be a problem? And the answer to that is that chemistry is very different in the sea than it is in fresh water, that when a fish is in the ocean, the water is saltier than the inside of the fish. And so the pressure of diffusion wants to move inside the fish, and that would be unhealthy for the fish, so the fish has to actively pump salts out of its body, and that's what fish do in seawater is to maintain their salt balance. They pump sodium out of their bodies
and fluoride out of their bodies. Fluoride out of their bodies.
Well, exactly, because the fluoride won't come in because they're pumping everything. Right. They're pumping salts out.
And it's in the sea, the fluoride is present as a dissolved salt.
That's
solution.
Correct.
Got it.
That's correct.
So. Okay, I'm sorry.
But,
please.
Okay, but in freshwater, am I getting too technical?
No. Okay. This is important. I think one of the things that is happening is that there's an enormous degree of popular cultural mythology. I want to just add this point. Ironically, the question of fluoridation has become a question of class and culture.
It is
good, well-intentioned, well-educated, well-incomed folk are the majority of the supporters of fluoridation. People on the fringes of the social system, whether they are Tea Partiers or old-time conservatives or libertarians or to some degree leftists, an odd combination there.
It's very odd to have the libertarian down the street have the same lawn sign I do. This has never happened before.
Right. But the point I'm making is that this is what I call scientism, the religion of science.
Uh-huh.
There's a set of assumptions that there are experts who are in the public health field and are medical doctors and and these people know best, and everyone else is bathing in superstitious ignorance. And one of the reasons why we're having you on, and one of the reasons why we're allowing you to have this long and serious chemical discourse, is because people need to understand exactly what's involved, and they need to understand very clearly that we ain't crazy.
I'd like to go to the phones here pretty soon, but first of all, I want to challenge you on that. Are you suggesting that we don't listen to science, that we don't take the opinions and the results of the scientific community at face value?
Well, let's look at what science has given us and what science has hurt us with. We are told by the scientific community that we have an acceptable risk of any number of pollutants because those scientists are, let's face it, economically bound up with the corporations that provide that pollution. We were told for years that nuclear explosions were okay, and then as the science mounted, finally public pressure, particularly around the issue of strontium-90 in the milk of mothers, nursing mothers, forced us to go underground with our nuclear tests, and finally both the Soviet Union and the United States decided, hey, let's just stop doing this because it's bad. It took a long, long struggle. While the majority of scientific opinion, particularly in the fields that paid well in nuclear physics, were all for testing. It was essentially a case of following the money. And I have to say there's an element of cognitive dissonance involved. That is, if you're invested in some process, you're going to believe in that process inevitably. And we see that time and time again. And I believe that a large part of the medical / scientific community is invested in the process of fluoridation. And their motives, and I'm not imputing anything about their motives are very sincerely a desire to reduce caries in children. And indeed, fluoride will do that. And there's many ways of applying fluoride to the teeth. The most inefficient, the most unmeasurable, is to put it in the water, because I may drink 4 glasses of water, you may drink 10 or 20.
And diabetics tend to drink more than other people, and they are people who are particularly susceptible to the problems of low fluoride concentrations.
Yeah, that's all well and good, but I want to talk about this notion of scientism, that there is an almost religious belief among a certain portion of the population in anything that the scientific community says.
Right.
Because they believe that it's grounded in empiricism and it is a rational way to evaluate the world.
I want to distinguish between the public health community and the scientific community. I hope that doesn't annoy people in public health. But there is a tendency. We are listening to the public health community, and the scientific community is being fairly quiet about things. When the scientific community does try to say something about it, they end up in bad straits.
Okay, but I'm here to say that this conceptual framework that you call scientism is a slippery slope. I still think there's some inherent value in empirically measuring and rationally evaluating the world.
Oh, no, I don't mean that there isn't. I believe in science.
Okay, good. Glad to hear you say that.
To quickly sum up then, in freshwater, the difference between the saltwater and the freshwater, just getting back to our chemical analysis, in freshwater, the concentration of salts inside the fish is higher than the concentration outside, and so the pressure of diffusion makes those salts want to move out. So the fish, to keep its healthy salt balance, has to pump sodium back into its body. Sodium is where the engine happens. Chlorine, being negatively charged, follows the sodium. But fluorine is also negatively charged. So if there's fluorine in the water, that follows in it as well. So that 2.5 times its body volume per hour pumping action is going on in freshwater and straining the fluoride out of any fluoride that's in the water out.
Okay.
So a number of things came up during that last piece, and I'm trying to figure out which direction to go. Fluorine that would have been released into the atmosphere, which we know is a bad idea, is scrubbed out, turned into fluorosilicic acid, and that is the form in which over 90% of the fluoridation chemicals in the United States.
Fluorosilicic
acid, also called hexafluorosilicic acid or hydrofluorosilicic acid. It's fluorine with the silicon molecules or atoms around it, which, as Max was saying, is not a chemical that occurs in nature particularly. And it has been shown that it is contaminated with other heavy metals, with arsenic, with mercury, with lead, with cadmium.
Wait a minute. Arsenic, mercury, lead, cadmium?
Yes. And do you know what the EPA permissible levels of those chemicals in drinking water is?
No.
Zero.
It is zero, right, as a matter of fact.
Really?
So, yes. Yeah. And just with some testing that was just done recently, they found about half of the samples of fluorosilicic acid had arsenic in them. So
is this real? You're saying that there's arsenic and lead and cadmium in the water consequent to the addition of fluoride?
Yes, it's actually on the CDC's webpage. They observe that has happened.
Okay. This is the Abe and Joe Talk radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM on your dial. We're here talking about fluoride.
I'm really depressed.
I know you are. More so than usual.
So we know that Can I talk about the other aspects of it?
Okay. Well, I was
going
to go to the
phones. Where are you going? Where are you going?
I was going to the phones.
Well, okay. I want to say three more things.
Say three more things.
Okay. Three more things.
Okay. You've already scared the hell out of me.
Okay. Well, so we looked at the environmental effects.
Yeah.
We know very little. We know less than we should. It is it has an effect on the environment at very low concentrations. The other two big questions are, does it actually work?
Mm-hmm.
And is it actually safe?
Yeah, I mean, what about the kids?
Well, there was a study done in by the National – no, it's not called the National Health Service. In the United Kingdom, the York University study is called. In 2000, they said, okay, find out about fluoride. Does it work or not? Look at all the data that there is.
Mm-hmm.
And their,
so they did a kind of a meta study.
They did a meta study.
Yeah.
And their conclusion was all the data sucked. There's nothing – there are no good studies. No one in 80 years has done a good study.
Wow.
And don't – they said, don't do any more bad studies. It doesn't help. Do good studies now. And so in response, the National Health Service in the United States funded a study called the Iowa Fluoride Study, which is the first – amazingly, the first controlled experiment looking at ingestion of fluoride and tooth decay also and bone disease and fluorosis. And – it's an ongoing study. It's they follow these children from birth. They monitored exactly how much fluoride they took in, and they found that there is no correlation between ingesting fluoride and tooth decay. There doesn't have any relationship.
You're kidding!
There is a relationship. They found a statistical relationship between ingesting fluoride and fluorosis. So it does. The actual good scientific data that now exists shows that it does do damage and it doesn't do any good. They also found that there was a correlation between frequency of tooth brushing and tooth decay, that brushing your teeth works. And there's a lot of evidence to that effect, that using fluoride toothpaste, fluoride mouthwash does reduce tooth decay, but that drinking fluoridated water does not.
Okay. Let's take some phone calls.
Well, yeah, okay. We will. But I just this is all – this just blows me away. The question I'm going to ask after the phone calls is what happened in Portland and what's happening in the nation and how is it that this fluoridation popularity took place? And we'll talk about that after some calls.
All right. Who's up, Steve? Will, good morning. Bill, sorry. Go ahead.
Hello?
Bill.
Hey, Bill. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Oh, okay. Yeah. From what I've read, 70% of the American public now consumes lives on water supplies that are fluoridated. I guess
that's about correct. Yeah.
the cities of San Jose and San Diego, California, have just adopted fluoridation within the last few years. My understanding is that the levels of fluoride in the oceans are higher than what the gentleman just quoted. It's more like 2 parts per million,
it varies from one area to the next.
There's still a few fish are surviving in the ocean somehow. That's quite a bit higher than the adjusted fluoride in municipalities.
That's correct, Bill. That's because in salt water, they can tolerate much higher levels of fluoride than they can in freshwater. Our concern is with freshwater.
Why is that?
Oh, didn't I just explain that? I did. But the reason is that in salt water, fish have to pump salts out of their bodies and in order to maintain their salt balance because the water is saltier than the inside of the fish is. But in fresh water, because the inside of the fish is saltier than the outside, the fish has to pump salts into its body. So whatever salts are in the water are going to go through the body, and that includes sodium and chloride. It also includes fluoride. So fluoride doesn't enter the body of a fish in salt water. It is constantly run through the body of a fish in fresh water.
Okay. I think there's... I think, again, this comes back to my notion of scientism. I think there's an enormous deference displayed to official health authorities. My background includes training as a medical sociologist, which I spent 3 years doing.
I didn't know that.
And that's a true fact. And I worked under the marvelous direction of Mitch Greenlich, who is now a legislator and who at the time was running the Kaiser Research Foundation. And I'm sure he must be really angry at me to hear me saying exactly what I'm saying. But he is, and Mitch, I'm sorry to say this, you are a captive of this notion of things. My most significant concern right now is there, in fact, an advantage to industry of finding a way to use the waste fluoride and avoid the costs of burying it or disposing of it.
As far as I can see, that has to be the motivation that's going on, is that if they don't sell it to cities to put into drinking water, they have to pay a significant amount of money to dispose of it safely, because you can't just dump fluoride in a pile somewhere. It's a fairly expensive process.
Mm. The Sierra Club estimates that it will cost the city approximately $575,000 each year to buy fluoridation chemicals and operate the fluoridation plant that they're going to have to build.
Uh-huh.
So this is essentially an industry able to turn a toxic waste product into a profitable retail product.
And now, it's interesting, as the caller said, 70% of Americans are drinking fluoridated water. 97% of Europeans are not drinking fluoridated water. 0% of Japanese are drinking fluoridated water. The rest of the the developed world isn't fluoridating their water. How could I have said that?
Yeah, really.
Australia fluoridates a little. Israel fluoridates a little. England and fluoridates a little. Ireland fluoridates quite a bit. But he mentioned a couple of American cities that have just started fluoridating. Mm-hmm. At the same time, Albuquerque and Santa Fe just stopped. A lot of communities have been abandoning fluoride who have used it for years because they realize that with the current science, it isn't actually effective and it isn't particularly cost effective.
Well, now, my understanding of Europe is that the number of caries is lower than here.
It depends on the country, but basically the Surgeon General some years ago said, since fluoridation, American caries have decreased, and so fluoridation is obviously the cause. That same curve of declining caries is found, like an identical curve, in countries that fluoridate and in countries that don't. The reason for the improvements in dental health are a combination of better dental care and better nutrition. And that seems to be a universal thing throughout the developed world.
Okay, let's take another phone call.
Yeah.
Who do we have, Steve? Mike, good morning.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. I listened to you yesterday on the Earth Day program. I have a couple of questions, and I did call last week, and my comments were about fluorine affecting soil and the soil organisms. You know, good, healthy soil. I come from a horticultural background. I've been in farming all my life.
Mm-hmm.
The effects of fluorine on living organisms and soil, has that been studied?
I wouldn't be surprised. I know that it's an effective pesticide. It's the main ingredient in a lot of pesticides. But
yeah,
I'm not a soil scientist, so I don't have a lot of data on that.
Yeah, well, that's one of the biggies. Since if you live in Portland and you have a garden, you have very few choices in watering your garden other than Bull Run water and during the growing season, occasional rain. So there's going to be a toxic buildup.
I think that's
because
true.
Because of the tight bind.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's really actually a good point. People need to understand that when fluoride is added to the soil, it has nowhere to go.
Right.
Yeah.
So inevitably, through time, and how much time is a good question, it's going to build up. Just like any other salt.
And it'll be toxic to soil organisms to some degree in some concentrations, and I don't have any figures on that.
Yeah. Well, and it does beg the question, why do fertilizer companies take fluorine out of fertilizers?
Oh, that is a good question.
That is an interesting question.
Absolutely. They take it out of the fertilizer and they put it into pesticides, which makes a lot of sense.
What's going on? My second question is, since there are citizens of Beaverton that get Bull Run water, do they get to vote on this?
No,
they don't, and neither does Gresham.
Neither Beaverton nor Gresham get to vote on this issue.
Neither do salmon.
And the salmon, of course, have no vote. Anyway, listen, did you have a third question?
Thank you for your time.
Okay.
That's a good work, gentlemen.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Now, he makes some interesting points.
He does, yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so how would we go on? Yeah.
You asked, what about the children?
And what about the children?
That is the major argument, it seems to be, of the pro-fluoride
forces. Do you want to cripple the children with the bad teeth?
No, I don't. And the thing is that nobody wants wants children's dental health to be affected and wants to find cheap, universal, effective solutions.
Right.
Fluoridation, however, turns out not to be that.
You're saying it has no effect significantly.
I'm saying that many studies have been done that have shown that, well, the primary problem in poor children with tooth health, what's called early childhood caries or baby bottle tooth decay. Mm-hmm. And it's because they're drinking milk or juice that has sweets in it. They have no other, or I'm assuming. And so it causes the teeth to decay to a terrible degree at a very early age. So that's a very bad thing. And it is exactly as prevalent in areas that have been fluoridated for many years as in areas that are not.
Well, I actually want to make a point here, which is a social observation. Beginning in the 1930s and building through time to today, the notion of formulas for babies has gained status. The idea of breast milk has lost status amongst everyone but the very wealthiest, in fact.
Yeah,
so there's a great irony there. One of the signs of this is that in poorer communities, one of the ways one calms a child is to put a bottle to the child, and the bottle often has anything.
Right.
It'll usually be a sugary thing.
Right.
But it can also be a formula. And while formula is a reasonable replacement, it does not truly mimic natural mother's milk.
For one thing, natural mother's milk has extremely low levels of fluoride in it. Breast milk has like 0.0004, I think. Maybe it's 0.004 parts per million. And so the body is, I mean, even if the woman is drinking fluoridated water, the breast milk has a very low concentration. The body knows that infants need very low levels of fluoride, and it takes the fluoride out of her body fluids before turning it into milk.
That's interesting.
So babies who are bottle-fed end up having much higher doses of fluoride than anybody else in the population because they have small body weight and because their entire food intake is in the form of liquids. And so they end up with – and that is the thing about fluoridation. There is no other medicine that we administer to an entire population by putting it into drinking water. It's an unregulated dose. If you go to a doctor or a dentist and he prescribes fluoride for you, he's going to tell you, here are the tablets you should take, and you should chew them and spit them out, and you should do it this many times a day and no more, because fluoride is toxic. It's a medicine. There is no other medicine. I'm sure there are children who are bipolar, and we could put lithium in the water so that we make sure that
Just put lithium in the water.
Sure. But no one suggests that, because lithium isn't a major industrial byproduct.
I think we should just put caffeine in the water.
Well, you can buy that. the other question, with the whole follow the money question, I have seen no investigation on this at all. So this is just spinning out of the top of my head. We know that industry is putting a lot of money into this, and the pro fluoride forces in Portland have about five times as much money right now as they have. Close to $500,000. Anti is in like $140,000 range right now. but there's also the case that if Portland's water is fluoridated, everyone who can afford it and who knows what's going on is going to buy bottled water. And so I'm curious as to whether the bottled water industry has any role.
You mean like Nestle and people like that?
Like Nestle and people who are trying to bottle water that's not in Portland and sell it to us.
It's possible, but I think
there's no research. I'm just making this up.
Indeed.
But it seems likely.
Indeed. If we start wandering off in these directions, though, I think it makes it easier for the pro fluoridation side to knock us down as a bunch of conspiracy theorists.
I think that's the case, which is why we try to
indeed,
be careful
stick
about
to the science.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
that's
and
a wise
I,
approach.
I mean, here I am thinking about all this. The science,
stick to the scientism.
Yeah, the science. From what we can tell, and Howard has made it very clear, does not support fluoridation of water. So I don't care about conspiracy theories one way or the other, but I want to know, and I wish I had time, and I wish I had the energy, and I wish I had the staffing to research exactly how it was that Randy Leonard on the city council suddenly became a heavy advocate. Of course, he was running the Water Bureau. became a heavy advocate of fluoridation, and that, boom, suddenly this was presented to us just as he was leaving office, and boom, the city council, in a great rush, approved fluoridation. I want to know who was a player in this. Is the head of the Water Bureau a player in it? I mean, there are questions here that really need to be answered. And my main point is, if you are at all concerned about the truth and if you're concerned about public health, you don't want to just blindly vote for fluoridation. You want to hold off. You want to find out all the scientific facts involved and make a rational decision. This electoral process does not allow for a rational decision.
If you want to fluoridate, self-fluoridate. That is your right as an autonomous
human
being.
Absolutely. It is, and it's effective.
There is
good evidence about that.
My kids got fluoride pills that they spit out, and I think they even had the bite into the wax thing at the dentist with fluoride embedded in it. And those things were fine. But those are, and this is a really important point, those are part of what we could afford, because we were fortunate. We had the money to be able to take our kids to the dentist and to the pediatricians. The problem is really that public health in this society is so mediocre, so bad, so inactive, so ineffective, and so limited, that this is, it represents to the population of people concerned about children a cheap, easy solution to what is a complex, expensive, really single-payer approach that needs to be done.
So Andrew Young used the former ambassador of the United Nations, colleague of Martin Luther King, was a fluoride advocate for many years. His father was a dentist, and like everybody else, he thought it was a good thing. But in Georgia in 2011, they tried to go statewide with fluoridation, and he fought it because he was concerned about poor babies being forced to drink fluoridated water. He said, this is an issue of fairness, civil rights, and compassion. We must find better ways to prevent cavities, helping those most at risk to obtain access to the services of a dentist. And that's my point, is if we've got $7 million to build a fluoride plant, why not create a citywide program for access to dental health universally for all children? It, you know, fluoridation is...
Because that's socialism, man.
Well, I guess so. Fluoridation is an early 20th century technology. It seemed like a good idea at the time, and the more information we get about it, the less it seems like it's actually a good idea. And I've heard fluoride activists say that we must join the 21st century. This is not a 21st century idea. The 21st century idea is universal access to health care.
Right.
And so I'd like to see...
Well, here that's a 21st century idea. Everywhere else in the world it's a 20th or 19th
century
idea.
You're right. It is. That's a good point.
It's been done. I think we should give the phones
I think we should. Who's up next, Steve? Brian, good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Pretty good.
Good. Hey, listen, I want to ask Howard a question.
Okay.
Okay, so, you know, just this is a hypothetical. Well, not you might know this. So I call the University of Stockholm right now, and I say, hey guys, what's up? Oh, hey, how are you? We break the language barrier. I go in there, I say, do you think I should fluoridate my water? My name is Portland. What would they tell me?
Throughout Europe, I don't have the actual word for word quotes, but in fact, the directors of health of each European country, with the exception of England and Ireland, have said, they have said the evidence doesn't support it, and that we don't think it's ethical to put a drug in the water.
Okay, so now, let me make my point.
Okay.
The University of Stockholm, University of Denmark, whatever, I'm just pulling
the
names.
Yeah, you're hypothetical.
But they're good ones. They're advanced socialist societies that don't fluoridate.
They are also statistically higher on the scale. Their universities have proven to perform better. They've turned out more graduates who are more qualified to do more work. And they're not as beholding to corporations as our graduates and our professors and our researchers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, wouldn't you agree with that?
I would.
Okay. So, I want to ask, we are sitting 45 minutes into this argument, and we're arguing with crazy people. Because crazy to me is somebody who absolutely does not want to acknowledge what the reality of things are. Now, the reality is we have people on a higher, and I've always, as a younger person, I learned to listen to people who have more knowledge than me. you know, or who are not corrupt in their knowledge.
You may be the first younger person who ever did that, but go ahead.
Right. No, I was taught to do that. I was raised in a very small town.
Anyway, make your point, because we want to get as many people
okay,
as possible.
Okay, the point is this, is like, okay, and I'll make this point, to asking our professors and our colleges and our researchers if it's okay to have we should have fluoride in our water is like going to Toyota on a down year and asking, should I buy a new car? Have a nice day.
All right, thanks. He makes a good point.
He does.
The intersection of profitability and getting rid of a toxic poison by selling it to the people as a health measure, it's unmistakably the case. The only real issue that remains is actually, will fluoride help us? And I'm seeing more and more evidence that it'll, at best, make no difference, and at worst, maybe be a problem.
There does seem to be a role. The latest data is showing a relationship between low doses of fluoride and bone cancer. There's a rare bone cancer in children called osteosarcoma. The prevalence is significantly greater in the presence of fluoridated water than in the absence.
Really?
Of it. Yes, that's the case. A study out of Forsyth Medical College, I believe, is where that one came from, Phyllis Mullenix and company. Mm-hmm. There was another study. The National Toxicology Program put out a study in, I think, 2003. The head of drinking water, the head toxicologist for drinking water, the EPA, looked at those and went, well, there are all these tumors that have been downgraded. They should be rated as full tumors. And for some reason in the report, they've been downgraded. He took them to other toxicologists without telling them what it was and said, what do you think about this? Well, those are tumors. And apparently somebody in the government had pressured them into censoring the report by reducing the how bad the results looked. He complained. He was fired. He fought it, and 4 years later was finally reinstated. Robert Reich, who was Secretary of Labor at the time, said that his firing was obviously punishment for protesting fluoride. I want to talk about chemicals for just a second.
Okay. Hey, 1 second. We got to take care of a little business here.
Okay.
We can get right back to that. Coming up this morning on Cable at 9 on Alternative Radio, journalist and author Martin Lee speaks on medical marijuana. At 10,
Chris Andre, I knew you were going to do that, dude.
You are as predictable as the tides, my friend. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary at 10:15 on Flashpoint. So look at the environmental toll of war and militarism. We'll also look at the connections between right-wing U.S. congressmen and Chechen separatists, an analysis that gives a different perspective to the alleged Boston bombers. And Norman Solomon talks about the use of anti-personnel weapons against innocent civilians.
Yeah, I don't know about alleged. In the case of the Boston bombers, come on.
He hasn't been convicted.
So no, but come on. Anyway.
He's right. We do have a justice system.
Bill of Rights and all that, you know.
Yeah.
At 11 on Stage and Studio, join guest producer and host Sarika Mehta for a special on gifted singer Kiran Aluwalia. And if I mispronounce that, my apologies. And then at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Terry Hopkins about two shows on incarceration that she has curated at the Art Gym at Merrillhurst University. Julie Green shows The Last Supper, 500 plates, and consists of 500 hand-painted ceramic plates showing what death row prisoners ordered for their final meal. Wow.
Yeah, I know about this. It's kind of cool thing.
And Buddy Bunting's The Prison Industrial Complex is a series of large-scale drawings of modern American prisons. All this and more coming up today on your listener-supported radio station.
Yeah, and you are listening to KBOO 90.7, your FM dial in Portland, Oregon. We are talking about fluoridation in a scientific sense, and our guest is Howard Patterson.
That's correct.
Hey.
So our chemical regulatory system in the United States is not aggressive. There are approximately 8,000 new chemicals a year produced by industry.
A year?
Yes. This is something I learned in a toxicology course from Dr. Eugene Foster at PSU, and I said the same thing you said. 8,000 new chemicals that have never existed before. The responsibility to test them for safety is with the government. It's not the responsibility of industry. So they can release those 8,000 chemicals. If the government, at its own expense, finds any toxicity, then the government can go forward with trying to ban them. Do you know how many chemicals have been banned through this process?
I do not.
Five.
Wait a minute. There's 8,000 new ones a year?
And five so far. Dioxin, chlorofluorocarbons. I can't remember what the other three are. But yes, that is the case. And Now, in some countries, as in European countries, for instance, I keep holding up Europe as if it were a place where their government worked. In European countries, the responsibility is of industry. If they invent a new chemical, the regulatory agencies say, fine, is it safe? And they say, yes, can we see the evidence that shows that it's safe? And they are not allowed to manufacture and release it until they've proven its safety. We, on the other hand, are living in this chemical soup of unidentified chemicals whose safety has not been identified. Now, when you do toxicological tests, you look at the chemical and whatever animal you're testing for and work with various concentrations to see at what level it is, how lethal. Then if you want to test two chemicals at once, you have to go through that same process, varying the concentrations of both chemicals to see how they interact, because every chemical will interact with every other chemical in the body of an organism. So we have to test 8,000 new chemicals a year is beyond the scope of science. But fluoride is one of the most reactive compounds in the periodic table. And if we put it, even in small concentrations, into the environment, into this astonishing chemical soup, we have no idea what new compounds will be created or what toxicity those compounds will have.
But we do know that there's an unusually rapid rise, in cancers of uncertain origin.
That is true.
And we do know that there is, in general, a series of assaults on our health through the introduction of a variety of chemicals in agriculture and elsewhere.
Exactly so.
And it seems like a no-brainer.
Good segue from no-brainer is that a study came out last year in Harvard that looked at 57 studies around the world and found a definite correlation between lower IQ and high fluoride ingestion, that fluoridated communities had children with significantly lower IQs than in non-fluoridated communities.
So we're literally dumbing ourselves down.
That's correct. So when people say, well, I drank fluoride my whole childhood and I'm just fine, you have to think about where that came from.
But all you're proposing is more burdensome regulations that hurt the job creators.
That's correct. That's exactly what I'm proposing.
Wow, you did that very well.
Thank you. Let's go back to the phones. Thomas, good morning.
Yeah, hi. I'm an anti-fluoride person, and I've read, you know, several of the books, you know, which ones they are, the big ones about anti-fluoride. And but what I think the anti-fluoride people need is to communicate with the general public, you know, we people who do the research, look into it, hear the facts and all that stuff, that's fine. But it seems it's a small percentage of the population. The rest of the people are going to be swayed by a public relations campaign because they come in and they pull our heartstrings about the children and the poor people. They totally dismiss all of these facts. They confuse the people and say that their science is good and that the anti-science is bad and junk science and all that stuff. And then you get the city club endorsing this and the city council. You know, the lady that's the head of the pro-fluoride group in Portland called Paul Connett's book fear-mongering, and he asked her, I heard the interview, I think it was on KBOO, he asked her, well, give me an example. She said, your whole book is fear-mongering, and she hadn't even read the book.
Well, first of all,
I'm suggesting that the anti-people need better public, some sort of a better public relations campaign, because the facts are overwhelming, but they're overwhelming. I mean, you can't convince people with the scientific facts when you're going to do a battle, in the public forum.
Well, I think that, first of all, I'm going to make a prediction. I think this measure is going to fail. And I think there's enough people.
I think you're right.
I think the problem, and I want to say this right here now to this audience. If you call everyone you know, and if you go to the website on this, which is, what is it called?
Clean Water Portland.
Clean Water Portland. If you will do that, if you will call everyone you know and tell them to vote no on this issue, your friends, if everybody does their task in this democracy and gets the vote out, because this is an off-year election, and they deliberately put it with the children's measure on the ballot. See, it's the other measure on the ballot. If you will say no and do it in a way that reaches out to everyone, you know, this measure will fail. The problem is to break through the smug, and I do believe it is smug, assumptions of the well-intentioned upper middle and upper class dominators of our public discourse.
I actually have a video about this that I'd like to recommend to people if they're trying to convince them. You can find it at my YouTube page, Howard Patterson, or at my website, howardjpatterson.com. Mm-hmm. And there's a 5-minute version and a 30-minute version. The long version is better, but it's just because it actually has all the data in it. But I have had a number of people tell me that they were pro-fluoride until they saw it, and now they are not. So that's a good thing.
That's a very important point. I think when knowledge meets fiction or fantasy or even well-intentioned, then knowledge can win. But only if people find out the truth and only if people reach out to their friends. The simplest thing about this is if you're the most liberal person, if you're the most tolerant person, this is something we are not clear about as a people. We have real and serious and valid doubts. Why in hell do we want to push an expensive and dangerous program without all the evidence that we need?
It is also ironic that the Bull Run water source is one of the cleanest and purest in the world.
Yes, that is ironic.
And the idea of putting, there are toxic chemicals in it. We put chlorine in it because federal law mandates that we do so. It is not, we don't do that for people. We do that to kill bacteria.
Right.
And a thing I want to point out is that you can't filter fluorine out the way you can chlorine. It takes very, very expensive processes.
Right. So people would have to spend a fortune on reverse osmosis and say, hey, we're running out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. We'll keep on pushing this issue until the election or they take us off the air because we're being bad.
All right. We're back at you next week.
Listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on alternative radio, journalist and author Martin Lee speaks on medical marijuana. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a look at the environmental toll of war and militarism. We'll also look at the connections between right-wing U.S. congressmen and Chechen separatists, an analysis that gives a different perspective to the alleged Boston bombers. And Norman Solomon talks about the use of anti-personnel weapons against innocent civilians. At 11 on Stage and Studio, join guest producer and host Sarika Mehta for a special on gifted singer Kiran Aluwalia. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Terry Hopkins about two shows on incarceration that she has curated at the Art Gym at Merrillhurst University. Julie Green's show is The Last Supper, 500 Plates, and consists of 500 hand-painted ceramic plates showing what death row prisoners ordered for their final meal. And Buddy Bunting's The Prison Industrial Complex is a series of large-scale drawings of modern American prisons. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. There is still time to contribute. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. Now here's Alternative Radio.
Cannabidiol, CBD. Maybe you heard a little bit about it. It turns out that this compound has tremendous medicinal properties, according to scientific studies, again, that the U.S. government has funded in large part, and it's non-psychoactive. It doesn't get you high. And when combined with THC, it can actually neutralize the psychoactivity of THC so that you can have marijuana, as there are certain rare strains in California, pot that doesn't get you high. But for people that don't like to get high, they can really reap a lot of medicinal benefits from this.
That's Martin Lee, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Martin Lee on medical marijuana. Marijuana, cannabis, weed, grass, by one name or the other, you've heard about it, and maybe even tried it. An Irish physician, William O'Shaughnessy, introduced the therapeutic use of marijuana to Western medicine in the 1830s. He gave it to patients to help treat muscle spasms and stomach cramps. Marijuana as a medicine became common throughout much of the Western world by the 19th century. It was the primary pain reliever until the invention of aspirin. Today, there are underreported scientific breakthroughs, including the discovery of a non-psychoactive component of marijuana, CBD, which stimulates adult stem cell growth, prevents the onset of diabetes, and shrinks malignant tumors. By mining the plant's treasure trove of active ingredients, medical researchers have developed promising treatments for cancer, heart disease, glaucoma, Alzheimer's, chronic pain, and many other conditions that are beyond the reach of conventional cures. Our guest today is Martin Lee. He's co-founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the New York-based Media Watch Group. An award-winning journalist, he has investigated the CIA and its drug experiments. His classic book on the topic is Acid Dreams. He's also the author of The Beast Reawakens and Smoke Signals. He's the director of Project CBD and a contributing editor of O'Shaughnessy's. He spoke at the Peace and Justice Center in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And now, Martin Lee.
I want to start by sharing an anecdote that I didn't include in Smoke Signals, the book, but it's about a character who's in the book. It's the late Robert Randall, who's I describe as the Rosa Parks of the medical marijuana movement. In 1976, he made legal and medical history by challenging the government and winning the right to use the only medicine that helped to control his glaucoma, an inflammatory degenerative illness of the eyes, and most people go blind with that. And he argued successfully in federal court that any sane person would break the law if it meant saving his or her own eyesight. And the judge agreed with him, and it was the first time a medical necessity defense had been used for marijuana successfully. But he went further than that. He insisted that the government had to supply him with cannabis, because for him to obtain it, if he would buy it from somebody, he would have to involve